What's up out there, everybody? Welcome to Movies Never Say Die. This is episode 9 of our top 100 movies from the 1990 series, and we have hit the final stretch. Today, we're counting down entries 20 through 11, a lineup so stacked it could headline a film festival and sweep the Oscars in the same week. This is where unforgettable performances, masterful direction, and pop culture dominance collide. We're talking about the movies that just really rewired your brain, broke your heart, or made you walk out of the theater quoting every line. These are 10 movies that I think turn stars into icons and single moments into cinematic history. So dim the lights and get cozy. The top 20 is underway, and this batch is peak 90s power. Keanu Reeves, Sandra Bullock, and Dennis Hopper race against the clock in Speed, the pulse-pounding thriller where a city bus becomes a bomb on wheels and stopping isn't an option unless you're into explosions. Now, speed is what happens when you combine a ticking time bomb, a moving city bus, and the face of 1994's most quietly intense action star Keanu Reeves with a dead-eyed and delightfully over-the-top Dennis Hopper holding Los Angeles hostage via remote detonation transit terrorism. Speed was just the adrenaline shot that the 90s action genre needed. Sandra Bullock and her breakout role really is fantastic. She takes the wheel literally and figuratively, and the chemistry between her and Reeves just sparks perfectly for the needs of this movie. This wasn't just a popcorn blast, it was really a masterclass in escalation. I mean, every time you think the worst is over, they end up jumping the bus over a gap in the freeway or transition to an out-of-control speeding subway. The director, Jan DeBont, he really paces this like a rocket launch with no deceleration, and Mark Mancina's pounding score just still kicks ass to this day. Speed also redefined the idea of high-concept thrillers. What if Die Hard happened on a bus? The answer? $350 million plus worldwide, a spot in pop culture's permanent rotation, and a regrettable cruise ship sequel. But don't let Speed 2 Cruise Control muddy the legacy. The original gave us action done right, Keanu in his pre-Neo era, and Sandra Bullock becoming America's movie-going sweetheart, all before the bus ever slowed down. In 1995, Pierce Brosnan stepped into the tux as 007 in GoldenEye, a slick Bond reboot that pitted him against a former MI6 agent gone rogue, complete with exploding pens, tank chases, and a Nintendo game legacy cemented in history. After a six-year hiatus and the end of the Cold War, Bond was at a crossroads. That was until GoldenEye would crash land into the mid-90s with Pierce Brosnan charming his way into the tux. This movie really had everything: a rogue 00 agent played by Sean Bean, a deadly satellite weapon, and a sexy and villainous Xenia Onatopp who literally crushed men with her thighs. Was this movie subtle? Absolutely not. But was it effective? 100%. Brosnan was fantastic. He balanced suaveness with grit, and director Martin Campbell was able to bring modern flair without ditching the Bond DNA. I mean, growing up in the 80s, I enjoyed and I appreciated the Moore and Dalton Bond movies, but GoldenEye, when it was released, was just next level for a 17 or 18 year old me, and Brosnan was peak cool. He was like a Irish John Shaft with a martini and a bow tie, from the bungee jump opening to the tank chase through St. Petersburg. I mean, GoldenEye made the franchise feel cool again, and who could forget that iconic N64 video game adaptation, which arguably introduced Bond to an entire generation via headshots and remote minds. I mean, GoldenEye didn't just revive 007, it gave him a stylish upgrade. It gave us Judi Dench's debut as M. It set the tone for a sharper, more aware Bond era, and Brosnan's performance stuck the right note between lethal and likable. It may not be the grittiest Bond, but it's definitely one of the slickest, and for many, it was the gateway drug into the spy genre. In 1990, Arnold Schwarzenegger would take a wild trip to Mars and into his own fractured mind in Total Recall, a sci-fi mind-bender filled with memory wipes, mutants, and more identity crisis than a season of Westworld. Arnold Schwarzenegger would take us on a Martian-themed mind-bender in this ultra-violent, ultra-fun sci-fi fever dream from Paul Verhoeven. Total Recall really is what happens when you give Verhoeven a Schwarzenegger-sized budget, a story by Philip K. Dick, and you add an unhealthy obsession with identity, violence, and exploding heads. The result? A fun, sweaty, epic, full of fake memories, mutant revolutionaries, and the most unforgettable three-breasted supporting character in movie history. By the way, I still say two is plenty. Arnold here plays Quaid. He's a construction worker. He has dreams of Mars and a secret identity possibly buried in his brain. And what follows is just a relentless series of chases and betrayals and shootouts and existential panic, all mixed with Verhoeven's signature blood-soaked satire and just future dystopia absurdity. I was like 13, maybe 14 when this movie came out. My grandma wouldn't let me go see it. She even went to our go-to video store and told the lady not to rent R-rated movies to me because of this film. And luckily, I had a friend whose dad loved these action movies. He bought a VHS copy, one that we would go on to watch relentlessly, of course, when everybody was asleep. And this movie still holds up. The film's special effects still look great, with just gloriously grotesque practical work, stop-motion mutants, tracking devices and skulls that need removal from the nose. I mean, Total Recall isn't just sci-fi action. It's unhinged sci-fi action. It's bold, it's loud, it's definitely weird, and it's still cooler than the other side of the pillow. Rest in peace, Stu Scott. John Travolta, Samuel L. Jackson, Uma Thurman, and Bruce Willis crisscross through a world of hitmen, diners, briefcases, and adrenaline shots in Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction from 1994, the non-linear crime classic that redefined cinematic cool. Now, by the time Pulp Fiction hit theaters, it kind of felt like someone had jammed a defibrillator into the chest of 90s cinema. With Tarantino at the helm, this wasn't just a movie. Pulp Fiction was a vibe all to its own. It was a mixtape of coolness, carnage, and conversations about foot massages and fast food. The film structure, told out of order but somehow perfectly timed, just gave new life to non-linear storytelling. I mean, every scene feels iconic. Vincent and Mia's twist, Jules quoting Ezekiel before dropping bodies, the adrenaline shot, the gold watch, it's all burned into pop culture like a Royale with cheese. I remember sneaking into this movie after watching something else. I showed up in the middle. I was completely lost and left early, but a few years later and a little bit older, I was starting college and this movie would really be able to get my fresh set of eyes, and I instantly loved just the controlled insanity of it all. Travolta would get a career revival, Jackson delivered a career-defining monologue, and Uma Thurman became the poster child for postmodern cool with a killer soundtrack and a screenplay that practically sings. Pulp Fiction became the indie success story of the decade, walking away with the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, changing the way movies looked, sounded, and talked. I mean, Pulp Fiction was more than influential. It was contagious, and whether you think it's brilliant or overrated or both, there's no denying its impact. Everybody wanted to make a movie like Pulp Fiction. Only Quentin Tarantino actually did. Tom Cruise, Jack Nicholson, and Demi Moore battle military secrets and courtroom ethics in 1992's A Few Good Men, the legal drama where the truth isn't just inconvenient, it's shouted at you with full-blown intensity because sometimes the truth just can't be handled. Few courtroom scenes in cinema have the electricity of A Few Good Men's climactic you-can't-handle-the-truth moment, and it's a scene that has entered the pop culture stratosphere for very good reason. Directed by Rob Reiner and adapted from Aaron Sorkin's play, this legal drama delves into military justice with all the gravitas and drama you'd expect from 90s cinema, plus some top-tier acting to boot. Tom Cruise stars as the young, idealistic Navy lawyer tasked with defending two Marines accused of murder. Then you get Jack Nicholson's Colonel Jessup, who just embodies the iron-fisted military mentality to a T, bringing a simmering intensity to his performance that just explodes into one of the most quoted speeches in film history. Then you get Demi Moore. She adds a quiet but powerful performance, kind of caught between duty and conscience. While the plot occasionally does dip into melodrama, the razor-sharp dialogue and just powerhouse performances make this more than your typical courtroom drama. To me, this is like one of those old Hollywood, just old school movies that just kind of relied on acting and writing and direction. The film also taps into some bigger themes about authority and honor and moral ambiguity that still kind of resonate today. And A Few Good Men is the kind of movie that reminds you why dialogue can be as thrilling as a gunfight, especially when delivered with such fire and conviction. Wesley Snipes and Woody Harrelson hustle street courts and egos in 1992's White Men Can't Jump, a pure summer basketball comedy about trash talk, trust issues, and whether or not Jeopardy is a valid life goal. Me, White Men Can't Jump effortlessly combines basketball, sharp banter, and a surprisingly heartfelt look at friendship and hustling on and off the court. Wesley Snipes and Woody Harrelson just bounce off each other here with an undeniable chemistry. These dudes really are perfect together for this movie, trading trash talk and life lessons in equal measure. I've always loved this movie. I remember when I was in my teens, I went on a vacation to LA, and getting to play basketball on the same Venice Beach courts this movie was filmed on was certainly an item checked off my bucket list before I even knew what a bucket list was. Directed by Ron Shelton, this film uses street ball as a backdrop for exploring racial stereotypes and economic struggles and just the pursuit of respect in a world that often feels stacked against you. But the duo's hustle, though, it's not just about money. It's also about survival and kind of proving your worth in a game that's bigger than basketball. The movie's humor is sharp. It's very witty without being cruel. And the supporting cast is fantastic, headlined by a fiery Rosie Perez, who just adds depth and warmth and humor to the story as well. Plus all the basketball sequences, they still feel very dynamic and very realistic, capturing the rhythm of street ball perfectly. And to this day, the action in this movie is still some of the best used in a basketball flick. White Men Can't Jump isn't just a sports comedy. It's a snapshot of like early 90s culture wrapped in sneakers and slam dunks. And to me, it will remain a timeless comedic classic. '70s screen legend Pam Grier plays it cool and calculated in 1997's Jackie Brown, Tarantino's slick and soulful Elmore Leonard adaptation, where flight attendants smuggle cash, middlemen double cross, and everybody talks just a little too much. Now, to me, Jackie Brown is the smoothest, most laid-back Tarantino movie with less pulp and more soul. Pam Grier leads as the titular character, a smart and streetwise woman caught between the FBI and a ruthless arms dealer, played by a pleasantly volatile Samuel L. Jackson, with Robert Forster as a bail bondsman and Robert De Niro as a low-key gangster. The film blends crime thriller suspense with sharp dialogue and slow burn tension perfectly. I mean, unlike Tarantino's more frenetic works, Jackie Brown is a movie that takes its time. It builds characters through subtlety and wit. The soundtrack is as cool as the characters, mixing 70s funk and soul to just perfectly match the film's vibe and just overall atmosphere. It's a movie that really rewards patience, in my opinion, with twists that don't really shout at you, but more so whisper, and a protagonist who's always one step ahead from start to finish. This, personally, has always been my favorite Tarantino movie. I think it also is one of his films that has the most amount of rewatch value to it, and it certainly feels the most grounded in all the best ways. Jackie Brown may not have the same bombast as Tarantino's other films, but it's got style, it's got heart, and the kind of cool confidence that only comes with experience. Here, Keanu Reeves infiltrates a crew of Zen surfer bank robbers led by Patrick Swayze in Point Break from 1991, an action cult classic where adrenaline is a religion and every wave could be your last, but it doesn't matter when you're just living in the moment. Point Break is just a high-octane mix of surf culture and heist thriller that somehow balances extreme sports and explosive shootouts with world-class bravado. Keanu Reeves plays Johnny Utah, an FBI agent who goes undercover in a band of charismatic bank robbers slash surfers, led by the legendary Bodie, played by Patrick Swayze, whose love of surfing and freedom naturally clashes with the law. Director Kathryn Bigelow keeps the action taut and stylish, just delivering adrenaline-pumping sequences on land, sea, and in the air. The film is equal parts philosophical and pulse racing, exploring themes of loyalty and risk and the quest for transcendence through the most extreme means possible. I can still remember sitting in the theater and watching some movie and seeing this trailer come on before it, and the mood, the vibe, all of it just grabbed me immediately. So much so, I ended up moving to the beach and picking up surfing because it just seemed less stressful than robbing banks. Now, Point Break is also packed with many quotable moments, including Bodie's famous line about living life to the fullest and Utah's moral wrestling with friendship and duty. I mean, Point Break quickly became a cult favorite, inspiring remakes and memes and countless viewers to pick up a surfboard. And what Bigelow would bring to the screen, I think, would end up being one of the best pure action movies the 1990s would have to offer. In 1995, Bruce Willis would return as John McClane in Die Hard with a Vengeance, this time teaming up with Samuel L. Jackson, with New York City turning into a playground for them to solve deadly puzzles left from a bomber who's way too into Simon Says. The Die Hard franchise would reach new heights and new puzzles with Die Hard with a Vengeance, turning Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson into reluctant partners who must race through New York City in a deadly city-wide scavenger hunt, trying to stop a bomber who has a flair for sadistic riddles. This installment in the franchise would trade in the traditional singular location for a sprawling urban cityscape, and it was perfect for blending fast-paced action, witty banter, and the charming chemistry between Willis and Jackson. This movie just cranks up the scale immensely with car chases, much more action, bomb threats, and enough explosions to give everybody in the city a headache. So by adapting more of that Lethal Weapon formula, Die Hard 3 was able to turn into a massive hit off a script that was intended to be a Lethal Weapon movie. Now, personally, I've always loved this one, and outside of the obvious quality and the nostalgia of the first, I would say this is the most superior film in the franchise due to the level of difficulty and all the moving pieces it has. Director John McTiernan delivers an action thriller that's part buddy comedy, part high-stakes puzzles, with memorable moments like the flooded viaduct, the car chase early in the third act, and this awesome finale on the tanker that delivers plenty of gunplay and just action and a great fight sequence. Die Hard with a Vengeance wasn't just another sequel. It was Die Hard with kind of a fresh twist, delivering the kind of energy that I think enables the film to remain a timeless action classic that's fueled on great writing, practical action, and its great cast of characters. Tom Hanks here leads a war-torn rescue mission in Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan from 1998, the absolutely visceral World War II epic that opens with D-Day chaos and marches straight into cinematic history, one bullet and brother at a time. I think many would agree that Saving Private Ryan changed war movies forever with its gut-wrenching, immersive depiction of the D-Day invasion and its aftermath. I think it also set a new standard in the genre for realism and depiction of sacrifice. The movie opens with one of the most harrowing battle sequences ever put to film, dropping viewers right into the chaos, fear, and heartbreak of combat like never seen before cinematically. I can still remember sitting in the theater, seeing that opening sequence for the first time, like it was yesterday. Tom Hanks here. He's fantastic. He stars as Captain Miller. He's tasked with finding and bringing home Private James Ryan, the last surviving brother of four servicemen. And the film just, I don't know, smoothly and just effortlessly explores the moral complexity of sacrifice and duty, all against the backdrop of one of history's most deadliest conflicts. I think Spielberg's direction, Kaminsky's gritty cinematography, and the cast's just masterfully committed performances brought unprecedented just authenticity to the screen in this movie. This film's impact was absolutely immediate. It was everywhere, winning multiple Oscars and just becoming a cultural touchstone for how war is portrayed in film. It's really a roller coaster of unnerving tension and emotion and action, making Save It Private Ryan more than a movie. It's a visceral experience that kind of honors the courage and the cost of those who fought, and it remains a benchmark for war cinema. And that's it for today, guys. That wraps up entries 20 through 11, another 10 films that didn't just leave a mark on the 90s. They practically burned their names into pop culture, with directors at the top of their game, actors giving career best performances, and scenes that still live rent-free in your memory lockers. This list just really proved that the 90s weren't playing around when it came to movies. With that said, we've now arrived at the final 10, the best of the best, the movies that defined a generation and maybe even changed cinema itself. So hit that like button, subscribe if you haven't already, share your predictions, and get ready, because in the next episode, we're revealing the top 10 movies from the 1990s. And trust me, it's going to be an ending worth sticking around for. Thank you guys so much for watching. As always, I hope you all have been enjoying this series. It's wrapping up in the next episode coming real soon. I hope to see you guys all back for that video, and until then, movies never say die.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Survive a war, you gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?
What's up out there, ladies and gents? We've laughed, we've cried, we've dodged bullets and caught feelings, but it has all come down to this. The top 10 movies of the 1990s are here. After counting down 90 unforgettable titles, we've reached the final stretch of cinematic greatness. These are the films that broke box office records, changed genres, and left permanent wear and tear on our VCRs. From explosive action to Oscar-winning drama, mind-bending sci-fi to twisted love stories, this list has it all. So whether you're a child of the 90s or just discovering these classics for the first time, buckle up for the ultimate nostalgia ride. So let's find out which 90s films truly stood the test of time. Ben Stiller, Cameron Diaz, and Matt Dillon in a truly unfortunate zipper incident headline There's Something About Mary, an outrageous comedy from 1998 from the Farrelly brothers about love, obsession, and hair gel that ended up changing rom-coms forever. When the Farrelly brothers unleashed There's Something About Mary in 98, romantic comedies pretty much changed overnight, veering from cloying and predictable to wild and weird, yet somehow still lovable. This one follows Stiller as an awkward everyman who has a decades-old crush on his high school dream girl, Mary, played by Cameron Diaz, and what begins as a sweet reunion attempt quickly spirals into a competition between increasingly unhinged suitors, all desperate for Mary's affection. I think the movie really does just walk a tightrope between gross-out gags and genuine heart. I think Diaz absolutely shines as Mary, delivering the just effortlessly cool and kind-hearted woman who could plausibly drive a dozen men to insanity. I think Stiller is hilarious as well, really just playing exasperated like it's a contact sport, and supporting players like Matt Dillon and Chris Elliott really do crank up the sleeves with comedic precision. I think everybody gets their moment to land some laughs, and the result is, to me at least, a laugh-out-loud comedy from start to finish. And but what I do really think sets Something About Mary apart was just its fearless sense of humor. The Farrellys weren't afraid to go big or inappropriate, but but they did anchor the chaos with enough charm to keep audiences on their side. The movie was an absolute box office juggernaut. It crushed R-rated comedy expectations. It gave us Jonathan Richman as a chorus singing troubadour. There are so many comical lines and scenes in this movie, and in short, There's Something About Mary made bodily fluids funny. It made Cameron Diaz a superstar, and it made awkwardness feel sort of heroic. Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman clashed in the nuclear submarine thriller Crimson Tide from 1995, a movie that turns claustrophobic tension into Shakespearean high drama with torpedoes, stare downs, and enough sweat to fill up the sub. Crimson Tide is the cinematic equivalent of locking two alpha intellects into a steel tube full of nukes and just watching the sparks fly. Directed by Tony Scott and written with a punchy urgency, this submarine thriller pits Hackman's old school shoot first Captain Ramsey against Washington's young cerebral Lieutenant Commander Hunter during a standoff over launching missiles without full orders. It's a tried and true submarine flick for sure, but it's also a philosophical showdown that's just wrapped in torpedoes and commands and soaked in sweat. Hackman's chewing scenery with a smirk while Washington's delivering a righteous intensity that all but burns through the screen. I really think this movie moves like a coiled spring. It's tight, it's tense, it's punctuated perfectly by Hans Zimmer's thunderous score that just overflowed with chance because it was mid-90s cinema after all. The tension that drives this movie isn't about whether the world will end, it's more about who gets to decide if it should, and that moral dilemma at the core just elevates this movie above genre conventions, turning mutiny and chain of command into just metaphysical battlegrounds. I remember seeing this movie in the theater with an uncle. He loved these military flicks, and despite being younger, I was all in on the drama and the suspense here. I think Scott's stylized direction just gives the whole thing a slick, anxious energy, and every supporting player from James Gandolfini to Viggo Mortensen just are able to add to this claustrophobic pressure cooker. Crimson Tide didn't just give us a great thriller, it gave us a just masterclass in verbal sparring and power dynamics, all wrapped in a film that relied on pure character acting. Steven Spielberg's 1993 blockbuster Jurassic Park brings dinosaurs back to life and nearly kills Jeff Goldblum in doing so, in the ultimate cautionary tale about science, capitalism, and theme parks with terrible security protocols. Welcome to Jurassic Park, where science played God, Jeff Goldblum's shirt was comically unbuttoned, and Spielberg reminded us that cinematic blockbusters could still inspire awe. Jurassic Park really was the defining event film of the decade, blending cutting-edge CGI, animatronic wizardry, and sheer cinematic wonder into something truly prehistoric in scale. The plot was simple at its core, but highly inventive. A billionaire builds a dinosaur theme park using recovered dino DNA. I mean, what could go wrong? Well, of course, everything will go wrong. Sam Neill, Laura Dern, and Jeff Goldblum just anchor the chaos here with grounded, fantastic performances that really turned their characters into legends, while Richard Attenborough's twinkly-eyed John Hammond just went from lovable grandpa to a cautionary tale in record time. This movie really was everywhere when it was released. I remember this being one of the first movies that I watched multiple times in the theater. Spielberg just masterfully balanced spectacle and suspense. I mean, the T-Rex breakout, it's still terrifying. The raptors in the kitchen, it's just dino carnage galore. And let's be honest, I mean, nobody looks at a glass of water the same way after this movie. Jurassic Park just was able to deliver an adventure-filled statement on hubris, ethics, and the limits of human control. And I mean, how about John Williams' iconic score? It's pure cinematic serotonin. The film broke box office records. It revolutionized digital and practical effects, and even decades later, Few blockbusters have matched Jurassic Park's sense of wonder. Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman chase a cryptic killer throughout a nondescript, rain-soaked city in David Fincher's Seven from 1995, a deep descent into madness, morality, and cardboard boxes that still haunts moviegoers to this day. Seven really became the cinematic equivalent of staring off into the abyss and having the abyss whisper back to you,
"What's in the fucking box?"
Directed by David Fincher with an unrelenting dread, this bleak masterpiece follows two detectives, the veteran Morgan Freeman and the rookie Brad Pitt, as they investigate a series of murders inspired by the seven deadly sins. It seems simple enough, but soon the mystery peels back like a rotten onion, with each new layer just nastier than the last. The rain never stops, the city is unnamed, but I don't know why, it always kind of felt like Chicago to me. Regardless, the hope level in this movie, it hovers like somewhere near a zero. Yet, despite all of that, I think Seven is still extremely mesmerizing. Freeman brings gravitas and quiet resignation to his role, while Pitt's impulsive rookie energy just explodes perfectly by the final act. Then there's Kevin Spacey's John Doe, chilling, calm, driven, and horrifyingly just convinced he's the hero of his own biblical message. He truly shows how intelligence and evil can be so frightening when fused together. I think Fincher's direction just really turns the urban landscape into a character of its own. It's grimy, it's decaying, it's morally bankrupt. The film's oppressive atmosphere just wraps around you like a wet newspaper. And the finale, well, if you know, you know. If you somehow don't, brace yourself. Seven really elevated serial killer thrillers and redefined them. It's nihilistic, it's unforgettable, and it made audiences walk out of the theater in stunned silence. In Fight Club, Edward Norton and Brad Pitt punch the 90s in the face in this nihilistic, subversive 1999 cult classic about identity, consumerism, and soap that probably smells like gloriously toxic masculinity. The first rule of Fight Club is you definitely talk about Fight Club, because this movie hit late 90s culture like a brick through a corporate window. Based on Chuck Palahniuk's novel, David Fincher's adaptation is a mind-bending descent into masculinity, identity, and consumer rage, all wrapped in sweat, blood, bravado, and nihilistic poetry. Edward Norton is a sleep-deprived drone spiraling into existential crisis until he meets this guy named Tyler Durden, played with a pleasantly greasy charisma by Brad Pitt, and what begins as a few guys in an underground fight club turns into a full-blown anti-capitalist, anti-consumerism insurgency, complete with an explosive finale and an unforgettable twist. A stylish, chaotic, and deeply quotable Fight Club would spark a million dorm room posters, including this guy. It's a film that both critiques toxic masculinity but is also co-opted by it, which is sort of the point of it all. Helena Bonham Carter's chain-smoking Marla is awesome, just adding an essential layer of emotional chaos and heartbreak to this testosterone stew. I think Fincher directs with a brutal elegance, turning soap-making into a metaphor and IKEA catalogs into horror shows. And while it was divisive upon release, Fight Club grew into a cult classic that continues to provoke conversation. It's not a love story, it's just a violently delivered middle finger complete with a black eye. In The Silence of the Lambs, Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins share brainy mind games and talk fava beans in this chilling 1991 thriller that made cannibalism Oscar-worthy and forever redefined the phrase, a nice bottle of Chianti. It puts the lotion in the basket, because The Silence of the Lambs put the psychological thriller genre in a chokehold and never let go. This 1991 Oscar sweeper wasn't just a crime drama, it was a disturbing, cerebral nightmare. Jodie Foster starred as Clarice Starling, a young FBI trainee who's just immediately thrust into just the darkest corners of human behavior and mentality, and she's without a doubt fantastic in this character. But I think it's Anthony Hopkins as Dr. Hannibal Lecter who steals every scene with just a chilling elegance, and with just about maybe 16 minutes of screen time, I think they said, he really was able to redefine villainy and elevate the meaning of terrifying. Director Jonathan Demme really does shoot this one with an intense intimacy, often placing the camera just uncomfortably close as if Lecter is staring directly into your soul, and it's super effective in creating uneasiness. The scenes between Starling and Lecter, I think, are a masterclass in dialogue, psychology, and dread. And meanwhile, Buffalo Bill's lurking in the backdrop as one of cinema's most unsettling serial killers of the 90s. I remember being brought to the theater by some older family members to see this movie. I was like 13, way too young to see this movie, and I didn't sleep well for like a week or maybe even a month. I mean, Silence of the Lambs isn't flashy, but it's smart, it's patient, it's razor sharp. It became only the third film in history to win the big five Oscars, best director, picture, actor, actress, and screenplay. It still slithers into pop culture conversations decades later, and rightfully so, because it's a haunting descent into the minds of monsters and of the people who have the courage to face them. Keanu Reeves takes the red pill and Bullet Time would be born in The Matrix, the 1999 sci-fi revolution where trench coats, philosophy, and slow-motion kung fu collided in virtual style and changed the game of action cinema forever. Now, The Matrix didn't just bend the rules of action cinema. It roundhouse kicked them in midair in slow motion. The Wachowskis' mind-melting sci-fi epic dropped just before Y2K paranoia would hit its peak, and suddenly we were all wondering if reality was, in fact, a simulation or just a very convincing lie. This was one of the very first DVDs I ever owned. I watched it so many times for several months with friends, girlfriends, family. By my lonesome, it didn't matter. This movie was on repeat for a while. Keanu Reeves is Neo, a mild-mannered hacker turned messianic kung fu warrior. And really, though, this movie isn't just about the trench coats and bullet time, as visually splendid and stylish as they were. It was really more a philosophical deep dive on control and destiny and waking up from complacency. Lawrence Fishburne's Morpheus was all gravitas and gospel. Carrie Ann Moss's Trinity redefined badass. And Hugo Weaving's Agent Smith gave us a villain so smooth that even his disdain sounded elegant. And with its sleek, cyberpunk aesthetic and its Eastern-influenced fight choreography and just a reality-questioning narrative, The Matrix became a cultural reset. The special effects changed in the industry. The dialogue for this movie would become meme fuel, and the red pill would enter the pop culture lexicon permanently. It was more than a film. The Matrix was kind of an awakening, and once you saw it, there was no going back. In Terminator 2 Judgment Day, Arnold was back. This time he was the good guy in James Cameron's 1991 action masterpiece where killer robots, molten steel, a little boy, and his nut job mother are going to fight to save humanity from itself. Now, with this movie, James Cameron would create the sequel. Terminator 2 turned Arnold Schwarzenegger's cold-blooded killer from the original into the most lovable cyborg guardian in movie history while simultaneously cranking the action, the emotion, and liquid metal innovation up to a 20 out of 10. Linda Hamilton returned as a transformed Sarah Connor, battle-hardened, paranoid, and absolutely ripped. Edward Furlong's John Connor felt perfect as the reluctant savior of the future, and Robert Patrick's T-1000 was a breakout, a shape-shifting nightmare in a cop uniform with the world's most terrifying poker face, and with groundbreaking CGI and massive set pieces like the canal chase, all topped off with an emotional undercurrent that sneaks up on you, and this sequel delivered the total package. But Terminator 2 was more than just shootouts and explosions. It had heart, sacrifice, and one of the most quoted catchphrases of all time, Hasta la vista, baby, is a quote burned into pop culture like molten steel. I remember walking out of the theater with my friend and his older brother. We were all really just in awe over what we'd just seen. Terminator 2 redefined what an action movie could be, visually, narratively, and emotionally, proving to be the future of blockbuster filmmaking, and it's still one of the best action movies of all time. Martin Scorsese's 1990 gangster epic Goodfellas turned the American dream into a coke-fueled nightmare, with Ray Liotta, Joe Pesci, and Robert De Niro slicing their way into cinematic history. As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster, and with that line, Goodfellas grabs you by the collar and drags you through 30 years of mob life, all set to the greatest jukebox soundtrack ever compiled. Now, as an Italian guy, I've always had this unconditional love for mob movies. Oddly enough, something about them feels kind of homey, kind of comforting in a sense, but I'm sure that probably tells you a lot more about me than it does this movie. Regardless though, Martin Scorsese's electrifying masterpiece here just perfectly tells the rise and fall story of Henry Hill, played by Ray Liotta, in just a world-class performance. He's flanked by Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro, who are both fantastic as well. Pesci's Oscar-winning performance really is just pure wild-card danger in a press suit. One minute he's cracking jokes, the next minute he's cracking skulls, and his unhinged personality just keeps you on edge perfectly. The direction in this movie is pristine, as you would expect. Every camera move, every cut, every line is precise and propulsive. The Copacabana Steadicam shot alone should be in the Cinematic Hall of Fame. And overall, Scorsese here makes excess look effortless as he takes you on a ride of mob life. I mean, cocaine-fueled paranoia? Check. Jailhouse dinners with garlic sliced razor thin? Iconic. Goodfellas was a revolution in the form of a gangster flick. It was stylish, it was brutal, and endlessly quotable. It really did redefine the mob genre while also reminding everyone that Martin Scorsese doesn't just make movies, he creates cinematic magic. In Heat, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro go head-to-head in Michael Mann's 1995 crime saga, centering on a high-stakes game of cat-and-mouse set to an LA backdrop of existential cool and legendary machine gun shootouts. So what do you get when you put screen legends Al Pacino and Robert De Niro on opposite sides of the law, then give Michael Mann and his directorial prime a camera and tell him to make the slickest, most emotionally intelligent crime saga of the 90s? You get Heat, an epic that turns the cops and robbers formula into high-stakes cinematic poetry. De Niro plays Neil McCauley, a cool, skilled, methodical thief who lives by a code. Pacino plays Vincent Hanna, a also skilled, caffeinated detective who eats pressure for breakfast and personal stability for lunch. And when these two titans finally sit down for a diner conversation, it's not just acting, it's action movie mythology being written in real time. This movie grabbed me instantly as a teen. It felt so cool and just real and gritty and lacking that usual Hollywood gloss. Man really brought just the seediness of LA to life perfectly, turning the city and its underground into just a moody playground for this game of cat and mouse. He delivers plenty of meticulous gunfights, particularly the downtown shootout that I think still holds up as a masterclass. And you get the supporting cast with names like Kilmer and Judd and Sizemore and Portman and many others, all helping to bring this dark but alluring world to life. Heat wasn't just about crime, it was about loneliness and obsession and greed and the cost of doing what you're the best at. I think Heat was very sleek. It was sprawling and surprisingly human beneath all the firepower. And upon its release, it was far ahead of its time. It was and is Michael Mann's best movie. And now I think it remains a timeless classic. And that's a wrap, everybody. 100 unforgettable films, 10 nostalgic episodes, and one glorious decade of cinema, from The Sixth Sense to Saving Private Ryan, Pulp Fiction to Point Break. The 90s gave us a little bit of everything and a whole lot of awesome. I want to thank you guys all so much for taking this countdown journey with me, rewinding through some childhood and teenage favorites, some film school staples, and some guilty pleasures that became legends, whether you agreed, debated, highly disagreed, or made your own list along the way. The goal was simple: to celebrate the unforgettable movie magic that this decade truly did deliver. Now go watch a few of these again, find them on streaming, maybe on DVD or a Blu-ray or that VHS tape that's still hiding in a box down in your basement. The 90s never really left, and they're always ready for one more rewatch. I want to thank you guys all so much for watching. I hope you guys have enjoyed this series. Be on the lookout for the next series of videos coming real soon. I hope to see you guys all back for that. And until then, you know the saying, movies never say die.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Live a war. You gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?